It's been more than a year since Edward Snowden first leaked news of the National Security Agency's collecting metadata on Americans. Now, while the jury is still out on whether Snowden is hero or villain, one thing is clear. The episode has changed how Americans and the world see the NSA and the technology companies that help it gather information. A new report from the Open Technology Institute aims to tally the costs to both federal agencies and contractors. Policy analyst Danielle Kale is the lead author, and she joins us now. Danielle, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, how did you seek to quantify the costs of NSA surveillance?
Sure. So we looked at this from a number of different ways. Some of this was conversations with folks in the tech industry. We looked at reporting of overseas tech sales from, I think, from big and small companies. So, you know, the big companies like Cisco, IBM, and Qualcomm, and even smaller companies like Servant, which is a web hosting company based here in Virginia that's reporting that it's seeing half of its foreign business cut in the past year. We looked at what's been happening overseas with contracts with foreign governments. So in December, Brazil announced that it was offering a multi-billion dollar fighter jet contract to Saab over Boeing, which is an American company. And in June, Germany actually announced that it was going to drop its contract with Verizon. And then we looked at a number of other studies that have focused mainly on the cloud computing industry, which is right now a fast-growing and U.S.-dominated market. And those are studies that have been done by a couple of other sort of economists that project anywhere from $20 billion to $180 billion in losses in the next 3 to 5 years. And that was followed up. There's been a number of surveys and variety of reports in the past year that have indicated that we're seeing that come to fruition already, people moving their data overseas, deciding not to move to the cloud because they're concerned. So then the sort of the last piece was looking at the non-direct economic costs, but the growing number of foreign government proposals about around data localization and national routing, which could cost U.S. businesses significantly more in the long run or even force them to pull out of some markets. And, of course, we also looked at the non-economic costs, and so that's our foreign policy, cybersecurity issues, and sort of a whole host of other related issues.
And when it comes to the economic cost, can you put a dollar figure on it? How much are we talking about?
It's hard to put an exact dollar figure on it. So I think the projections about the cloud computing industry, which, you know, widely range, are anywhere from, as I mentioned, 20 to 180 billion. The easiest dollar figure, the dropping tech sales, that's, you know, going to be billions of dollars this year and in the next few years, most likely. But the biggest challenge is that it's the missed opportunities that we think are going to be the most costly in the long run. So U.S. companies being left off of requests for proposals by foreign governments and foreign companies and sort of the longer-term market shifts as people move away from the United States because they don't trust us. That's part of the reason why it's really hard to put a dollar figure, even an exact dollar figure, even on the cloud computing losses, because it's such a fast-growing and competitive market.
And when it comes to something like that, the cloud computing, $22 to $180 billion, that's a very, very broad range.
Mm-hmm.
What accounts for that exactly?
So the range is based on whether or not it's just a drop, first of all, in U.S. sales overseas. So one option is that basically U.S. sales here, domestic sales for U.S. cloud computing companies stay mostly the same, but we lose overseas customers. That's the lower end of the estimate. As you get to the higher end of the estimate, we're talking about American companies seeing seeing lost sales even here in the U.S., companies here that don't trust American cloud computing businesses and would rather move overseas, or startups that don't want to start with an American hosting provider because they don't think that's a good way to get trust from their customers. And then the other end of it is that, you know, I think the other thing that's come out in the past year is this is not unique to the United States. And we've learned a lot about the surveillance that other countries are also carrying out. And so there's a very real possibility that we'll also see, you know, foreign customers in foreign countries dropping their cloud computing providers, not moving to the cloud as quickly, being much more hesitant. And so the highest end of that number is sort of a range of ripple effects in related industries.
And something that I think is really interesting when we're talking about cybersecurity is that you note that sales of technology, not necessarily cloud services, but sales from major American firms like IBM, Microsoft, Hewlett Packard, they're down in China, mm-hmm. which we think of here in the United States as being very insecure in
right.
terms of technology. What are people there or anywhere buying when they don't buy American?
So some people have joked that the biggest winner in all this is going to be Huawei, the Chinese company, because that was a company that it's been known for a long time. There have been, security vulnerabilities engineered by the Chinese. They make very cheap products, but there are concerns about insecurity. What a lot of people are turning to are they're sort of saying, well, I guess the U.S. companies aren't secure either. We'll go to a cheaper alternative, like a Chinese alternative or something else. It's a marketing technique, to be perfectly honest, from foreign companies at this point. So, there's a Norwegian company called Runbox that makes secure, that claims to have secure email service, and they're marketing themselves as NSA proof. So those foreign companies, they see this opportunity to sort of, poach sales from American companies, and they've jumped on it. And so one of the big things is, and I say claim to be secure because whether or not they are more secure, the perception among a lot of customers is that they either are more secure or that U.S. companies are just as weak, and now they're looking at the dollar, the bottom line, instead of making a decision about security because they don't trust the American companies either.
And I guess this might venture into legal ground, but in fact, is a Norwegian company any more quote-unquote NSA-proof than an American company?
It's hard to say. I think that, there are privacy protections in some countries, especially in Europe, that may be stronger than the privacy protections that an American company can offer you. That's not to say that either. One of the things we've learned is that the National Security Agency has a lot of different ways to get access to your data, regardless of where it's stored. So the NSA may still have access to your data. Those local governments may have access. That's one of the big challenges with data localization, and which is being put out as this sort of security fix by legal fix by a lot of foreign governments saying we want to store our citizens' data locally so it can be protected. That may be true. They may also be doing that because it's actually easier for them to access the data. So it really varies on a case-by-case basis. And as far as the technology is concerned as well, it's entirely dependent on the product that particular company sells. Just because you're based in Norway doesn't mean that your product is more secure.
We're speaking with Danielle Kale. She's a policy analyst at the Open Technology Institute. And despite the wide range of estimates of losses from 22 to 180 billion, again, using cloud computing services as an example, it's clear that companies are suffering. Have you seen American companies adapt over the last year?
Yeah, so we've seen a lot of, I think good faith efforts from companies in a number of ways. So one is on the issue of transparency, which is that a lot of the, especially big companies, have been pushing to the federal government to let them publish more about what the NSA is requesting, what the nature of these programs, because right now they recognize that there's a trust gap. The other thing that we're seeing is a variety of tactics to actually improve security. So we're seeing more internet service providers encrypting their traffic between data centers, encrypting their email traffic, offering individual users sort of add-ons that they can use to enhance their privacy. Microsoft and IBM are talking about the sort of like overseas data storage, so giving people an option to store their data outside of the country. So there have been a lot of good responses, and I think that's helped some. The other big challenge, though, is that it seems a lot of the time, every time there's, some steps forward, we see a couple steps back. So Cisco reports, dropping sales, and then maybe they recover a little bit. And then in this spring, we learned that the NSA was tampering with foreign-bound routers being shipped by companies like Cisco. So they were actually intercepting them and inserting malware onto them as they went overseas. And so that's one of the reasons why you've also seen a lot of vocal calls for surveillance reform from big tech companies that ordinarily don't, necessarily align with one another. They see this collective threat to their business interests, and they're calling on the government to change.
You already mentioned Huawei, the Chinese firm, but are there any other sort of beneficiaries? I don't want to say winners, but firms that have benefited from all of these revelations and people's newfound fears?
There are a number of foreign companies that are benefiting, especially the ones that are getting the contracts that American companies used to get. And so that's Saab is a good example in Brazil, which I mentioned earlier. there aren't a lot of beneficiaries. I think the really interesting thing about what's happened is that we're actually seeing a loss of trust in technology across the board to a certain extent. People all around the world are more suspicious now. And so that makes people more hesitant. That changes their purchasing habits, regardless. So I'm not really sure that across the board you could say that there are a lot of people turning to other services. They're just more concerned about what's happening and who's seeing their data.
And you have a bunch of recommendations that you say the federal government can take. I just want to ask you about sort of the quick wins. Some of them are much more structural, and we've already seen, witness Capitol Hill, that it's difficult to pass legislation having to deal with surveillance, especially in a time like this with world conflicts everywhere. What would you say are the recommendations that you think are quick and fairly easy wins that the government could take that could help both the government and its contractors?
Sure. So you're right. The Congress is talking about sort of the surveillance reform and transparency issues, but still going slowly. Some of the recommendations we talk about are things that the NSA itself could actually address. This on the question on the security issues, the questions of when they when they stockpile security vulnerabilities, so they find flaws in software, they don't tell the companies, they hold on to it so that they might be able to exploit it later. They can actually start participating more actively and in the disclosure process. They can develop processes and be more transparent about the processes that they have in place to ensure that they're not weakening cybersecurity. And then similarly, other parts of the federal government, I think, and are actually making these efforts already, like the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which has had its credibility sort of questioned in the past year because of allegations that the NSA weakened its encryption standards. They've begun already an internal review and an external review process of their processes and working on greater transparency. The State Department is working to rebuild the credibility of the Internet Freedom Agenda. Those, I think, are the wins that we can see, if things continue to head in the direction that they're heading right now, and if there's a concerted effort to address these costs, those are areas where I think we could see real progress much, much sooner.
Danielle Kale is a policy analyst at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute. Danielle, thank you.
Thank you.